Many people have remarked that mathematicians tend to be musical. Certainly, the list of mathematicians down through the ages who have either played a musical instrument or had a strong interest in music is a long one. To name but a few, Pythagoras, Euclid, Cardano, Galileo, Kepler, Descartes, D'Alembert, Euler. Now, D'Alembert and Euler were the two leading mathematicians of the mid-18th century. D'Alembert was also one of the leading music critics of the period. And in fact, as co-editor with Diderot of the great French Encyclopedia of the 1750s, he wrote not only the articles on mathematics, but also those on music. Now, Euler, of course, was the most prolific mathematician of all time. Euler also wrote a book on music. Here is how he described his purpose in writing the book. In a letter to Bernoulli in 1731, "My main purpose was that I should study music as a part of mathematics and deduce in an orderly manner from correct principles everything that can make fitting together and mingling of tones pleasing." The book wasn't actually published till 1739. It didn't do well. I'm sorry to have to report. Now, to continue with the list, Bolyai, Riemann, Jacobi, Kronecker, Sylvester, and in the early 20th century, I can mention Poincaré, Einstein, and Birkhoff. Now, Einstein, as you may know, played the violin quite well. By Birkhoff, I mean not Garrett Birkhoff, but his father, George Birkhoff, George David Birkhoff. In fact, Birkhoff's interest in music led him to write a book on the general aesthetic measure. So he wrote this book in 1833. There we are. In 1933. So in this book, Aesthetic Measure, here is his basic equation. M equals O over C. So he's trying to quantify beauty. I know, that's an ambitious thing, isn't it? Quantify. To assign a measure to how beautiful an aesthetic object could be. Now, this aesthetic object could be a piece of music, could be a poem, could be a painting, could be a sculpture. So what does this say? M is over C. O is the amount of order, if you like, the amount of harmony or symmetry that's incorporated into the aesthetic object. C is a measure of the complexity of the object. Now, he wrote an entire book about this, so this is oversimplifying it, but it expresses his hypothesis that the aesthetic measure of an aesthetic object is determined by the density of order relations in the aesthetic object. So, in other words, suppose you've got a very complex work of art or piece of music or whatever. Therefore, the denominator is large. So Birkhoff is saying to compensate for that, you should incorporate a high degree of order, a high degree of harmony or symmetry to compensate. Now, this was, as I said, a valiant attempt to quantify beauty. My own personal measure of assigning a mathematical measure to the worth of an aesthetic object would be this. Like, for instance, for a piece of music, I suggest the number of times you can stand to listen to a piece of music before becoming totally tired of it and not wanting to hear it again. That works for other aesthetic objects, too. In the latter part of the 20th century, I can mention Coxeter, H.S.M. Coxeter, Donald Coxeter, He told me that he used to take scores of Bruckner symphonies to bed with him as bedtime reading. He was fascinated by the geometric patterns in Bruckner symphonies. Now, I can also mention that, you know, I've played in a lot of university orchestras where the players have been students and professors from various departments of the university. And my observation has been that almost entirely they've been drawn from the departments of mathematics or science or medicine or engineering. Only very rarely did I meet someone from English or history or languages. So it seems to be a genuine phenomenon that those with mathematical talent are drawn to music. And so how would we explain that phenomenon that mathematicians tend to be musical? Let's start by examining some of the similarities between mathematics and music. First of all, both possess a precision that is reflected in notation. Both mathematics and music can be written down in a precise notation that is universally accepted. Now, it is this symbolism or notation that makes a page of a musical score and a page of a calculus book unintelligible to the uninitiated. Secondly, I think it is fair to say that music is the most abstract of the arts, and mathematics is the most abstract of the sciences. Of course, this is a very general statement. Music need not be abstract. Songs are not abstract. They relate to real concrete situations through the words of the song. And likewise, mathematics need not be abstract. It, of course, can be very down-to-earth and practical when applied to physics and other sciences. However, it is certainly true to say that both mathematics and music are capable of great abstraction. Neither Brahms' Fourth Symphony nor the prime number theorem have any direct connection with the physical world. Now, I think it's interesting to trace the history of how a concept in music or in mathematics has become progressively more abstract. For example, in music, in the 16th and 17th century suites and sonatas, they contain movements that were the popular dance forms of the day. So it originated in the physical activities of the dance. The pavane, galliard, allemande, courant, gavotte, bourrée, menuet, all dance forms. But by the 18th and 19th centuries, they had become more abstracted. They had evolved so much that they did not always resemble the original dance. A striking example is the menuet. Now, let's listen to a couple of examples. Now, typically in the classical symphony in the 19th centuries, the 18th century, the symphonies of Haydn and Mozart, typically the third movement is labeled menuet. So here would be a typical third movement of a Haydn symphony.
This is 96.
It has evolved somewhat from the daintier menuets of a century before that, but it still has the same tempo, 1, 2, 3, that you could dance a minuet to if you knew how to dance a minuet. But it evolved further in other Haydn symphonies, and especially with Beethoven.
So the third movement of a Beethoven symphony is typically in three. It's evolved directly from the minuet, but let's listen to one, and you'll see it's changed quite a bit. So this is the third movement from Beethoven's seventh symphony. So it's still in three. It's a direct descendant of the minuet, but you'd be hard-pressed to dance a minuet to that. 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Now, in mathematics, of course, there are plenty of examples of this increasing abstraction. Harmonic analysis provides a good example. Fourier series arose from the study of vibrating strings and heat conduction, but today abstract harmonic analysis on groups is indeed far removed from its origins. And in general, mathematical ideas that have ultimately empirical origins, once they get going, seem to live a life of their own, and motivation becomes creative and aesthetic in nature. Now, perhaps it is this abstractness that accounts for the following phenomenon. Have you ever considered the question, in which fields of human endeavor do child prodigies occur? Yes, exactly. The only two fields that I can think of are music and mathematics.
Chess is a hard one.
Yeah, chess.
Oh, okay. Now, I mean, after all, one never hears of 9-year-old poets or historians. Whereas Mozart and Mendelssohn come readily to mind in music, as do Galois and Gauss in mathematics. So why is it that child prodigy occur in music and mathematics? Well, a 9-year-old who is creating music or mathematics, unlike perhaps other fields, is not using an accumulated store of impressions, whether emotional or other, from his experience or his learning. He's instead drawing on his own inner resources. And therefore, I believe it is the abstract nature of these two fields that provides the explanation. Now let's turn to look at how music relates to mathematics in four aspects of music: rhythm, harmony, melody, and form. Now, I suppose that musicians think of rhythm as the chief application of mathematics to music. And it's true that the time signature of a piece of music, for instance 2-4 or 3-8, is a fraction whose denominator is always a power of 2 and whose numerator indicates the number of beats in a bar. Now, that only goes so far. I would like to discuss types of music where rhythm is the main component. Do you know about minimalist music? Minimalist music dates from the 60s really. And minimalist music is characterized by being very rhythmic. What it has in common with rock music is a steady pulse and lots of repetition. Where it differs from rock music is that there are often sudden shifts. And I'm going to illustrate that on some examples. Sudden phase shifts is what I mean. Now, among American composers are among the chief practitioners of minimalist music. And I want to discuss the music of these four American composers. First, Terry Riley in the early 60s was the seminal composer in San Francisco. He wrote one of his most famous pieces is called In C. It's in C major. But it doesn't change key at all there. He deliberately keeps it in C major, and it is characterized by steady pulses. Probably the most famous minimalist composer is Steve Reich. His clapping music is one of his more famous pieces, and I will illustrate that in a few minutes. Philip Glass is another minimalist American composer. One of his early works, very much in the minimalist mode, is Music in the Shape of a Square. He was a math major at University of Chicago, which he entered at age 15. And he went to a concert of music by Steve Reich and instantly attracted to minimalist music, and that became his style for a while. The fourth American minimalist composer I want to mention is John Adams, about half a generation later than the others. His most famous work, I suppose, is his opera, Nixon in China. Have you heard of Nixon in China? It's a great opera. And so, as an example of this, for those of you who have not familiar so much with minimalist music, let me play a little bit from Nixon in China. Nixon in China, this scene, there's about a 12-minute scene called The Chairman Dances, depicting Chairman Mao dancing. He dances by himself, and then his wife, the infamous Madame Mao, crashed the party. She wasn't invited. She was out of favor at the moment, but she crashed the party. He ended up dancing with her. This is how The Chairman Dances starts. And it's typical, you'll hear that steady pulse and the bars sound much like each other, but then there's going to be subtle gradations. Now, for the full effect, you have to listen to the full 12-minute passage. And like rock music, it creates a kind of hypnotic effect. At the end of the 12 minutes, you're kind of hypnotized by it. The other example I want to play is the Steve Reich clapping music. Now, this is purely rhythmic music. Here is the basic motif.
It's for two performers, each of whom claps. So there is no melody. It's all percussive in the sense of clapping. So this is the basic. Now, of the two performers, this basic motif is 3/8 notes followed by an 1/8 rest, 2/8 notes, an 1/8 rest, 1/8 note, an 1/8 rest, then 2/8 notes, and an 1/8 note rest. And the first performer keeps doing that through the whole piece, like that. The second performer, the second clapper, starts off the same for 8 bars. So they're in unison for 8 bars. And then there's a phase shift. The second clapper claps this. So there's a shift. He omits 1/8 note. So he moves an 1/8 note ahead and does this simultaneously with the first clapper. So it's... And then after another 8 bars, he shifts another one. He emits one more 1/8. And so on. Until at the very end of the piece, they come together again. So, no, I was going to ask for a volunteer from the audience to clap with me on this, but that might invite chaos. So instead, we're going to listen to Steve... I won't play the whole thing. It's about 5 minutes. And they do it rather more quickly than I have just indicated. So let me do a couple of minutes of this with this performance dating from, I think, late 60s or early 70s with Steve Reich and Russell Hartenberger. Now, the first shift has happened. The second shift just happened. Music in my house tomorrow night, as well as other pieces of Steve Reich. So you're all invited. You're welcome.
I'd love to come.
Or now there was a paper published in 1991 in the College Mathematics Journal by Joel Hawk, where he analyzes Steve Reich's clapping music. And it's a very, very interesting paper with group theoretic implications. He uses permutation groups to analyze it. There's some really rich mathematics involved. So I'm going to make a copy of that and present it to Steve Reich in case he hasn't seen it. So, or if you go to YouTube and search on Steve Reich clapping music, you'll find not that video, but a more modern one with one conductor and 9 clappers from a couple of years ago. And that's very good, too. And, of course, at the end, when they finish, the audience all claps. Now, so the question is, does this explain any connection between mathematical and musical talent? Well, over the years, I have collaborated with a number of mathematicians on playing chamber music. And I can report that many of the mathematicians have a really good sense of rhythm,
but many have a terrible sense of rhythm. So I don't think that provides... It's interesting mathematically, but it doesn't provide the explanation. So let's move on to harmony, which I think has a more substantial contribution to make. Now, and I'm going to explain the principles involved on a violin string, and I'm grateful to... I'm sorry, what was your name?
David
Kahn, for lending me his violin. I did not want to travel with my 18th century French violin because I used to travel across borders, you know, taking my violin and carry-on. But coming into the States, you can't do that anymore. And they put it into luggage. There's some horror stories about what happened to instruments, so I didn't want to do that. So I'm grateful to Dave for lending me his violin. Now, the frequency of vibrations, the pitch of a note, how high or low it is, depends on the frequency of vibrations. So, for instance, the A string on a violin vibrates at about 440 vibrations per second. Now, the equation that expresses the frequency in terms of the physical characteristics of the string is this. So the frequency is 1 over twice over 2L square root T over M, where L is the length of the string, T is the tension of the string, and M is the linear density, in other words, the mass per unit length. So physically, what is L, the length of the string? If I use the bow or pluck the string vibrates between the bridge and the end of the fingerboard. So this is L, this distance here. Unless I put my finger down fairly hard, in which case L is lessened. So now, putting my finger there, L is the distance between the bridge and my finger. That portion of the string is vibrating. So according to this equation, if I decrease L, being inversely proportional, the sound, the pitch should go up from to, and indeed it does. Now, in this connection, I can mention Pythagoras, and what is probably the oldest of all quantitative physical laws. The Pythagoreans noticed that the musical intervals, if you've got two strings forming a musical interval when the notes are sounded simultaneously, the most pleasing musical intervals are to the human ear are those that occur when the ratio of lengths of the two corresponding strings are a simple ratio of integers. And the smaller the integers, the more consonant the sound, the more pleasing the sound. So let's investigate that. So let's look at this chart and test out the theory of the Pythagorean theorems. The simplest ratio of integers is 1 to 2, or for frequencies, 2 to 1. So that means if I put my finger down on the midpoint of the distance from the bridge to the end of the fingerboard is right here, which gives you an octave above the original note, played simultaneously. So that is the most consonant of the musical intervals. Of course, it occurs in the music of all peoples. But beyond that, what's the next simplest ratio of integers? Well, 2 to 3. So what happens if I put my finger down 2/3 of the way from the bridge to the end of the fingerboard, which would be right here, which is the interval known as the perfect fifth, played simultaneously. And it's the perfect fifth is the interval between the open strings of a violin. So
the next would be 3 over 4, the next simplest. That's a perfect fourth. Played simultaneously. These intervals with the smallest ratio of integers, these constant intervals, occur in the music of all peoples. Ethnomusicologists have traveled the world studying the music of various peoples, and those intervals occur in the music of all peoples. When you get further down, larger integers here, well, somewhere between here and here is the thirds, a minor third and a major third. Now, we think of a minor third and a major third as being very pleasing intervals. But you know, they do not occur in the music of other peoples. In other words, it's an acquired taste. We think they're beautiful, but other people think they're ugly. And they're further down here. We get down to the bottom of the list, a semitone. The ratio of lengths of vibrating strings producing the semitone is 15 over 16, according to the theory of the early Pythagoreans. The later Pythagoreans, with a more complicated theory, regarded it as 243 over 256. Now, so let's see if they were right. So according to the Pythagoreans, that ought to be an ugly sound. Okay, let's see if they were right. So, what's a semitone? Played simultaneously. They were right. Now, it's a different matter on a piano. In an instrument like a violin, you can do the true ratios, but on an instrument like a piano, where there are compromises built in so that all semitones are the same, now, so if X is the ratio on the piano of lengths of vibrating strings, or ratio of frequencies, then X to the 12th has to equal 2, right? Because you've got to get to an octave. And so X is the 12th root of 2. So all semitones are the same on the piano, so it's the 12th root of 2. Well, on a true instrument, like a violin or a cello, you don't have these compromises that are built into a piano. But the 12th root of 2 is pretty close to 16 over 15. Now, at some stage, the Greeks became obsessed with the various means between two numbers A and C. So they had about 12 different means between A and C. So the simplest, of course, is the arithmetic mean, where B is the average of A and C, A plus C over 2. Now, what we call the harmonic mean, they originally called the subcontrary mean. And that means that the reciprocals are related. The reciprocal of B is the arithmetic mean of the reciprocal of A and the reciprocal of C. Well, let's compute. Suppose we take a string of length 12. Now, the octave above it would have length 6. Well, 2/3 of 12 is 8, so the harmonic mean or subcontrary mean would give you the 5th, and 3/4 would be 9, and so the 4th is represents the arithmetic mean. So that means that the 5th, the perfect 5th, is the harmonic mean between 12 and 6. And so the Greeks were delighted by that. So delighted that they renamed the subcontrary mean and called it the harmonic mean. And also note that 12 over 9 is 8 over 6. They were just delighted by this. Now, there are many fascinating mathematical problems concerning harmony and temperament. For example, using the theory of continued fractions, it can be shown that instead of having 12 notes in an octave, as we do, it would be better, from the point of view of tempered scales, to have 29, or 41, or 53,
And the analysis of the overtones and harmonics of a note is an interesting story of its own. But the many connections between mathematics and harmony do not explain why mathematicians tend to be musical. So let's look further. What about melody? Here, one frivolous use of mathematics would be to compute the vast number of possible melodies, thus reassuring us that there are many tunes which have not been composed yet. For instance, suppose we use Schoenberg's system of composing, where a melody consists of the 12 notes of the chromatic scale arranged in a definite order with no repetitions. How, in Schoenberg's scheme, Schoenberg's type of melody, how many would there be? So the number of tone rows, well, you could choose the first note in the tune in 12 ways, no repetitions, so 11 for the second choice, for the second note, 10, 9, 8, and so on. So you get 12 factorial, which is 479,001,600. This ignores any variation in rhythm. So if you incorporated rhythm, there would be many more. Now, if you decided to allow repetition, as most composers do, what would it be? 12 times 12 times 12, 12 to the 12th, which is almost 9 trillion. So there are a lot. And incorporating rhythm, rhythmic changes, that would introduce even more. So there's a huge number. I don't claim that these are all equally interesting melodies, but there is a huge number. There is, however, a more significant application of mathematics to melody. What makes a beautiful melody? What makes a catchy tune? It's subjective, of course. But one ingredient is symmetry. Symmetry of various sorts. I've chosen a couple of Beatles songs to illustrate melodies possessing both translational and reflectional symmetry. So first, let's look at this Beatles song For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, which uses translational symmetry. This is from the Sgt. Pepper album. So the melody is this. Notice the first complete bar is translated down a whole tone to comprise the second bar. So let's hear the Beatles sing it. Another example from the Beatles, well, from John Lennon specifically, called Power to the People, with reflectional symmetry. Now this is a very symmetric tone row, melody. So the mirror line is here, so in the middle you've got this eighth note, and this quarter note is reflected to these two eighth notes. That dotted quarter is reflected into that dotted quarter. So it's very symmetrical indeed, isn't it? It has more than one type of symmetry. It goes up in both directions, and also the duration of the notes is also symmetric. So it sounds like this. And let's hear Lennon and friends sing it.
Power to the people.
Now, this mathematical symmetry contributes subconsciously to our enjoyment of the music. Composers, whether consciously or subconsciously, often use symmetry or near symmetry of these kinds or of subtler kinds using other transformations in creating melodies. Now finally, I think we come to the heart of the matter. If I were asked to sum up in one word the essential similarity between mathematics and music, I would choose the word form, or what musicians call form and mathematicians call structure, for they're very similar to each other. Some composers have recognized this fact explicitly. Let me quote Igor Stravinsky, who many would rank as the leading composer of the 20th century. Stravinsky said that musical form is, and I quote, far closer to mathematics than to literature. Not perhaps to mathematics itself, but certainly to something like mathematical thinking and mathematical relationships. I think that if Stravinsky had known a bit more about mathematics, he would have omitted the qualifying phrase, not perhaps to mathematics itself. Because mathematics today is to a great extent concerned with structure, with the way that mathematical objects fit together and relate to each other. And the functions or transformations that mathematicians study on such mathematical structures as groups or vector spaces or topological spaces are those that preserve structure. Now, I claim that the various forms in music, such as sonata form, rondo, fugue, and so on, have much in common with the various structures of mathematics. Let's first look at sonata form, which is used in the first movements of most symphonies and concertos. The basic structure is this. It's somewhat symmetric. Aside from an optional introduction and coda, the first section, let's call it A, called the exposition, in which you've got more than one theme generally, A1 and A2, I've labeled them, is then developed in section B, and then essentially repeated, although sometimes more briefly, in the recapitulation. So there's this global symmetry. And these transformations that composers use in the development section, they take this theme that I've labeled A1 and transformed it into another musical passage related to the first one, and the like. Now this second theme, A2, connected to the first one via a bridge passage, is usually contrasting in nature. Let's play a typical example of the exposition section. Well, the most famous one of all, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, first movement. Second theme, a contrasting, more lyrical theme. Thank you. that was the exposition of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, First Movement. In the development section, Beethoven now takes these themes and subjects them to various transformations. Now, what are these transformations like? The transformations are very much like the transformations used in mathematics. They both have the property that they preserve structure. The transformations that a composer uses must preserve at least some aspect of the structure of the original theme. After all, to achieve maximum enjoyment of a piece of music, you have to be able to recognize that, say, A1 primed is derived from A1. Mind you, on an initial hearing of a piece of music, the connection may not be obvious, but after repeated hearings, you should be familiar enough with the shapes of the themes that you can recognize their images, at least on a subconscious level. Now, the remarks that I made about the transformations in the development section in sonata form apply to other forms as well, such as theme and variations and rondo. Now, the transformations that Bach used in his fugues resemble very closely certain transformations in geometry. On the left here, I've listed some common geometric transformations, and on the right, their musical equivalents. So on the left, we have the simplest transformation, a translation where you take this blue triangle and you just shift it, becoming this red triangle. What's the musical equivalent of that? Musicians call that transposition. So you take this theme and you shift it, in this case, down a perfect fifth, so that this original fragment shifted down a fifth becomes, and of course the ear readily recognizes that simple transformation. It sounds the same, it's just lower. What about other geometric transformations? Reflection. Does reflection occur in music? Sure. Reflection in a horizontal axis, where this blue triangle gets reflected across this mirror line into this red triangle. The musical equivalent is called inversion, where instead of going up a fifth and down a second, the melody goes down a fifth first and then up a second. So it becomes, although not as obvious as transposition, the ear easily recognizes some kind of connection. What about reflection in a vertical axis? So we flip this blue triangle to become this red triangle. What's the musical equivalent? It's called retrogression. So becomes, when reflected in a vertical axis. So basically, you're playing it backwards, right? So retrogression is playing a melody backwards. What about other geometric transformations? Do they occur in music? What about rotation? I mean, do composers use rotation? Well, Bach did. Here's a rotation about 180 degrees, where you take this blue triangle, rotate it about 180 degrees, becomes this red one. In music, it's called retrograde inversion. So we take this melody and rotate it through 180 degrees, so becomes, so it's really composed of the two previous ones. So in inversion, it comes into this as well. So basically, it's upside down and backwards. And Bach did that. He
took his themes and played them upside down and backwards. What else? Dilations or dilatations, where you take this blue triangle and you blow it up. You magnify it. So it becomes this red similar triangle. And in music, that's called augmentation. So becomes in other words, you're playing it slower. Typically twice as slow or four times as slow. And the other dilatation with a dilatation factor less than one, shrinking. So diminution is just playing it typically half as fast or a quarter as fast. Bach used all six of those transformations with close analogs in geometry. And for instance, in his A minor solo sonata, the fugue movement, the fugue subject is a very simple two-bar phrase. And a little while later, he transposes it, he down a fifth, so becomes. And further on, he inverts it, so becomes. So it's upside down, but the ear can still discern it. Good examples of this are in The Art of the Fugue of Bach, which really is a textbook example of what you can do with these transformations. So The Art of the Fugue has many such examples like that. Now, I claim that if you listen closely to a Bach fugue, you can hear the geometry. So next time you listen to Bach, listen for these six transformations. You can actually hear the geometry. Now, an example of a musical form which is very mathematical indeed is 12-tone music, or serial music. In the first two decades of the 20th century, many composers abandoned tonality. That is, they didn't write in any specific key. But they soon felt a need for some kind of discipline, some kind of unity, some kind of coherence. In other words, for some structure which would replace tonality. By 1923, Arnold Schoenberg had come up with 12-tone music. Let me briefly describe this. Instead of a theme, you have a tone row, as I described earlier, an arrangement of the 12 notes of the chromatic scale into a definite order with no repetition. So a tone row is really a very democratic melody. No note is more important than any other note. So each note must occur exactly once, and no note is more important than any other. This is in sharp contrast with tonality, where if you write in C major, C is the most important note. Here's an example of a tone row. This is the tone row from the violin concerto by Alban Berg, where you'll notice that in this tone row, in this order, he's arranged the 12 notes of the chromatic scale in a definite order with no repetitions, but in a very clever way. Notice it's minor third, major third, major third, minor third, minor third, major third, major third, minor third, as far as you can go. But also, he before the tone row is stated, there's a little prelude where he takes, he fashions an introduction out of certain notes from this. Notice if you look at notes 1, 3, 5, and 7, they're the open strings of the violin. So it opens with the open strings of the violin. And then, and interspersed with the harp. And then he does, so that's 1, 3, 5, 7, 7, 3, 5, 1. Then he does 2, 4, 6, 8, 8, 6, 4, 2. So next he does. And then 3, 5, 7, 9, 9, 7, 5, 3. So it's a very mathematical scheme.
But then, and then you hear the tone row, and then you hear the inversion. So I will point that out when
it occurs. Let's let Isaac Stern play it.
Here's the tone row. Here's the inversion. Very strict, but it's not as strict as it might seem, because the tone row can be used vertically in the harmony as well as horizontally in the melody. If this may be an acquired taste, but it's a taste worth acquiring. This is a really beautiful piece of music. It evolves into a Bach chorale by the time it ends. It's an extraordinarily beautiful piece of music. Not everybody agrees with me. Actually, I got out the score. Berg wrote two operas, Lulu and Vatsek. And before I attended both of those operas, I got out the score from the library and studied the scores. And each of those operas is based on a single tone row. It's 3 hours. It's based on a single tone, but you don't know it. You wouldn't realize it if you hadn't studied the score. They're really beautiful, beautiful, compelling operas. Now, let me quote somebody who doesn't agree with me. Here we are. I was reading the American Mathematical Monthly last December, and there was a review. Maybe some of you read it. You know, there have been a lot of books published on mathematics and music just recently in the last 2, 3, 4 years. And this review of two books on mathematics and music by Michael Henley, who's at Oberlin College, he wrote, serial music is another word for 12-tone music. Serialism and change ringing. Writers on music and mathematics can't resist flogging these two dead horses of mathematical music theory. And then he talks about the treatment in these two books of 12-tone music. Both Benson and Loy happily delve into primrose, pitch class sets, and other arcana of serialism. To be fair, this is a subject for which mathematics truly provides the right analytic tools, namely combinatorics and group theory. And then parenthetically he adds, if only what was analyzed were more musical. Well, I disagree. I disagree with it. It is an acquired taste, but you know, like many things in life, things that are acquired tastes are worth acquiring if they give you great pleasure. So let me put forward my final argument. Oh, I should mention also that musicians, composers, seem to need some kind of structure of one sort or another. This 12-tone music is one possibility. Sonata form is another possibility. But recently, composers have begun experimenting with other types of structure. Just recently, I found out about the Norwegian composer Rolf Wallin, who uses chaos and fractals. If you go to his website, Rolf Wallin, R-O-L-F-W-A-L-L-I-N, he's a Norwegian composer. He explains explicitly how he uses fractals and chaos to inspire his music. So composers seem to need structure, and often that structure is mathematical in one form or another. Now, I've spoken of form in music as an analog of structure in mathematics, but one could also regard it as an analog of logic in mathematics. A beautifully constructed proof in mathematics is like a well-constructed fugue or symphony. When the sequence of deductive operations flows swiftly and naturally to its inevitable conclusion, the logical structure of the proof gives a sense of satisfaction, of beauty, and of completeness. And one of the exciting things about a Bach fugue over a Brahms symphony is its compelling logic. J.W.N. Sullivan has said of the opening theme of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony that, I quote, "It immediately, in its ominous and arresting quality, it throws the mind into a certain state of expectance, a state where a large number of happenings belonging to a certain class can logically follow." So let's listen to that briefly again. So, with that fresh in your ears, let me read the Sullivan quotation again. "Immediately, in its ominous and arresting quality, it throws the mind into a certain state of expectance, a state where a large number of happenings belonging to a certain class can logically follow." The same might be said of many a musical masterpiece. I think this gives us a clue as to why mathematicians may be more interested in music than perhaps other arts. A piece of music takes place over a period of time. It unfolds. So mathematicians who appreciate a logical flow, a logical argument, can be expected to respond to this in music. So to summarize, my explanation for the abundance of musical mathematicians lies in the analogy between form in music and structure and logic in mathematics. Thank you.